If you're an athlete, you love pushing your body to the limit, but intense training can sometimes cause serious systemic imbalances, impacting both your performance and your quality of life. This is exactly what happened to me. My name is Christopher Kelly, and when I first moved to Silicon Valley in 2001 to work as a software engineer, I fell in love with the active West Coast lifestyle. Before long, I was competing and winning in the world of mountain bike racing. Life on the bike was amazing, but off the bike, I was plagued by a growing list of chronic health issues. Fatigue, insomnia, mild depression, zero sex drive, and digestive issues. My doctor said this is just what happens to athletes, but I wouldn't accept that. The doctor referred me to a gastroenterologist whose best recommendation was potentially harmful steroid drugs and invasive surgery. Luckily, around this time, I met my future wife, a brilliant young food scientist named Julia. She recommended that I try an elimination diet. Pretty soon, I was feeling better than I had in years. This got me wondering what else was possible. So I started exploring the world of advanced biomedical testing. Utilizing tests that many doctors don't even know about, I learned I had several nutritional deficiencies and chronic infections. By modifying my lifestyle and taking supplements, I eliminated these imbalances too. At this point, I was inspired, and I was wondering how many other athletes might be suffering from similar issues. So I teamed up with my wife, Julia, medical doctor friend and fellow mountain biker, Jamie Kendall-Weed, medical doctor and research scientist, Tommy Wood, to launch Nourish, Balance, Thrive. Together, we've developed a revolutionary coaching program that has transformed the lives and performance of over 1,000 athletes. If you're ready to be our next transformational success story, visit the URL mbt.ai and take our 7-minute analysis. Now, over to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly, and today I'm joining you with my chief medical officer, Dr. Tommy Woods. How are you doing, Tommy?
I'm good, thanks.
We are here in Iceland in person recording. The last 2 days we've been attending the Icelandic Health Symposium, and we thought that we'd do a recap for all of the listeners of the podcast. How's that sound, Tommy?
Sounds great.
Tell us a little bit about the conference. You were the host this year. I know you were involved in the organization of the conference. Tell us about it.
So the idea of the Icelandic Health Symposium came out mainly from a guy called Guðmundur Jóhannsson, who's the CEO of the board of the symposium. And he initially emailed me after he heard me speaking in Iceland about multiple sclerosis about 3 years ago now. And he wanted to create a conference, and he was particularly, back then, he was a low-carb kind of guy, and he's sort of expanded out from there since then. So he was excited about Gary Taubes, Tim Noakes, and he reached out to them and managed to get them to come and give a conference here in Iceland last year. And I spoke then, and we also did a podcast last year where we summarized very similar to this. And then this year, we wanted to focus on longevity, and so we had... Well, my role essentially was to help find and contact the speakers that I thought would be good to speak in this area. So we had a wide range of guys come and talk. And then either side of that we had, so Ben Greenfield came as one of the speakers. He did a workshop. We had Mark Kukuzela come. He's doing a running workshop today. And then we had also a practitioner workshop where we had Brian Walsh, Mark, Deborah Gordon, who's also been on the podcast. So everybody, they've all been on this podcast before, come and talk to practitioners and give us slightly more clinically oriented day. So we did that the day after the main conference. So the idea is both to help the public and the medical professionals in Iceland, those particularly who are interested, to sort of better understand lifestyle approaches to health and disease. And so you obviously empower the patient or the person before they become a patient to look after their own health, but then also help healthcare practitioners better understand how they can use these other things as well as traditional medicine to improve health. So that was the goal of the Icelandic Health Symposium. And there's more work to do to get more people in the door to listen to the speakers. And we'll, you know, hopefully that will continue over the years. But it was very well received. I think we had about 250 people on the main day. Some of the speakers and organizers were on the TV, have been in the papers since. So it's sort of had a bit of momentum and all the feedback was great.
What do you think the divide was like with the audience? Most of the people that I saw and talked to, they seemed like they were either health and fitness professionals of some sort or other, doctors. It didn't seem to be a lot of the lay public present.
Oh, I think the opposite. I think
Quite
a lot of the lay public.
Just the people I spoke to, probably.
Yeah, probably. I think there was a good mix, actually. And I mean, down the front, you had all the Icelandic CrossFit royalty. You know, you have some of the best CrossFitters in the world. You know, they showed up and they were all down the front. So you would consider them, they're not the lay public, but they are the public, right? They're not healthcare practitioners.
Advanced users.
Yeah, advanced users. And so you had advanced users, you had less advanced users, and then you had some healthcare professionals. And so I think there was a good mix. And then the idea was that we gave a broad range of both information, but then also details. So you would hopefully speak to different people on their own level throughout the day. And I think, you know, we got pretty close to striking the right balance.
Mm-hmm. And it's a great location, Iceland. It's so accessible from both the US and Europe.
And equally, if you're trying to get somebody to come and talk at a conference, telling them that you give them a free trip to Iceland is actually a really good sell. So there are so many of the speakers that we had both last year and this year, the first thing they say is, oh, I've always wanted to go to Iceland. So that's a really easy way to get top draw speakers, because they're excited to come and visit the country. So that's good too.
Doug McGough brought his whole family
and he loved it. Yeah, he was here for a week and they were traveling around and did all these various things. And he was talking about how much he'd enjoyed like traveling around first. So that was really good.
And I'm here with my co-founder, Jamie Kendallweed, and her husband is a professional mountain biker that makes videos. I'll link to some of Jeff's videos in the show notes for this episode. And he's here with a filming crew. So they're going to be making a video over the next several days, and he's brought all of his bikes, and luckily he managed to get me a bike. So I'm going to be able to ride here in Iceland as well, which is super cool. It is a fantastic place. We almost enjoy coming here. We spent the morning doing more of the hot, cold immersion therapy, which is fantastic. Really good fun. Let's talk about the speakers then. Rongan.
Yeah. So the first guy we had on the bill was Rongan Chatterjee, who people in the UK will probably know of as the doctor in the house, who's he's had a BBC series where he goes and shows what you can do if you actually spend a lot of time with your patients and really connect with them and figure out what's really going on with their health, and then can solve all these chronic conditions that are supposedly incurable. You know, he's this great, traditionally trained doctor. He's a GP in the UK, but he's also done some of the Institute of Functional Medicine stuff. He's done the Bredesen protocol training for Alzheimer's. And he just sort of has this great overview of health and all the different things that you can and should do. And he's also very good at making it accessible for people, and just incredibly enthusiastic and just such a nice guy as well. So he talked about, so he's just written a book, which I think will come out soon, based on his four pillars of health, which, you know, people listening to this may not be surprised, but they comprise of food, movement, sleep, and stress. And actually I got a question on Twitter to him about whether he thought there should be a fifth pillar, which was sort of love and social connection and relationships, and where those, he didn't get a chance to sort of talk about where those kind of fit in, but that's obviously like an important thing too. And he did sort of touch upon it, but those sort of four things are where he really focuses with his patients. And then, you know, we talk a lot about food, but maybe people aren't thinking as much about the movement, or if they're doing the movement, they're maybe not doing the right movement, or, you know, and the sleep and the stress are other things. And particularly for people who haven't really thought about this stuff before, then maybe we're kind of sold that it's so important that we have so much to do, and, you know, we have to look after the kids and work and all this stuff. And then, you know, we'll cut short our sleep, and maybe we don't really realize the implications of that. So how we handle stress. So I think particularly for people who are just getting into this kind of stuff, I think those messages are really important. Mm-hmm. Sort of those all being equal, right? Food's not just the most important thing necessarily, particularly depending on the person. So give a really good grounding of all the things that are important for long-term health. So that was a really great way to sort of kick things off.
I was sat next to Jamie in the audience as he was giving his presentation. And at one point he says, I see 45 patients a day. And Jamie just looked at me and went, how the heck does he have the time and energy to do this when he's seeing 45 patients a day? And do you remember he was talking about how he integrates movement into his work by taking the time to walk from his office to the waiting room rather than using the tannoy? And Jamie's just like putting her hands up, going, what the heck? Who is this guy? And how does he get this done?
I think it's just because he knows it's so important and he loves it. He loves doing it. And he did say that in the structure, because she asked him that question, and he said the traditional structure is that you book 20 patients in a day, but by the time you've done any emergency consultations, or you've gone to, you do like a house visit in your lunch break, and then you do some like follow-up calls. So then the number of patients who you have spoken to, interacted with in a day is close to 50, and to sort of keep up the energy and the enthusiasm. And then, you know, go home, write your book, also spend time with your kids, spend time with your wife.
Amazing.
Like his energy and passion is just incredible.
Insurmountable.
But it's just because he knows how important it is and he loves doing it. So it's just, it's amazing to see him in action.
Truly someone who has found their purpose in life, which we'll get to a bit later. My question is, why is this not the standard of care in the UK? You know, like there's nothing earth shattering in his presentation.
Yeah.
Why is this not the standard of care? And he's this celebrity GP that people are making television programs about because he's doing something different and getting great results. Why are people not noticing and this becoming the standard of care in the UK?
I think having spoken to some GPs and medical students, I think they are noticing. It's just stuff takes a lot of time to change. And I know there are a lot of GPs in the UK, and I'm sure it's the case everywhere, where just because of access to information, this is something that Rongan talks about himself, you know, with the internet and the access that we have to people doing the kind of stuff that he's doing, it's much easier to see this and think, oh, hang on a second, you know, this makes perfect sense. You know, why aren't we doing it? And I think there's a thirst for knowledge amongst the doctors who see the same patients coming back again and again and again. And, you know, you just change medications, try something new, it doesn't help, they get sicker, you know, and you become frustrated because what you want to do is actually help your patients. So when you first see the traditional model not getting the results that you want it to get, not helping the patients as much as you would hope to help them, and then you see these alternatives, and I mean, it's TV, so they make it look amazing, and they start with, they only show the complex cases when actually you could have an even bigger impact potentially for some of the simpler cases, but they don't make it to the, Rongan was talking to us about how he had some simple cases where he sort of just like happened to fix something just on the side, which wasn't really the intention, but because he was changing diet and these other things, you know, these health problems that had been around in people for years just suddenly disappeared. And the TV producers like, oh, that was too easy, we don't want to put that on TV. The ability to do that, you know, I think people are seeing that and starting to ask questions. And that's what you can really ask for at this point, you know, when we're sort of stuck in the quagmire that we are stuck in. If you can just put this information out there and get people to start asking questions and thinking about it themselves. And a lot of the speakers talked about that, actually. It was not just, here's a prescription, this is what you need to go out and do. It's, you know, I want you to think about this. And if you think about it and you think it's important, then maybe that's going to stimulate some change either in yourself or your practice. And that's, I mean, I think that's the best way to get people started.
I know his TV series will be available on the BBC iPlayer. I'm not sure how accessible that will be in the US. Maybe we can find some of his TV. And I, the reason I think that might be important is this might be a good entry point for somebody who's listening to this podcast. Could you send, hey, Dad, watch this on the iPlayer?
Yeah.
And it's TV. It's mainstream TV. So it's entertaining. And at the same time, there's this message in there that may nudge the, we've been talking a lot about, or I've been talking a lot about pre-contemplators and contemplators after interviewing Simon Marshall. And maybe it would nudge the pre-contemplator into the contemplator zone. And that could be important. Maybe not for the people listening to this podcast directly, but for people that they know and love.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that point, exactly, Rongan did say that the second series has managed to hang around on YouTube. So the first series, somebody put it up and then it was immediately taken down.
Okay.
So we'll just say, look for it. It might be, you might find it.
Yeah, poke around on the internet.
On the internet.
Okay. Well, moving on, I can't pronounce it. Lila, am I getting that right?
Lilia.
Lilia. Oh my goodness. I'm sorry, Lilia. Yeah. Okay, talk about that. So there was a change of speakers. It was going to be Dominic. Can you talk about why Dom wasn't there? Are you not allowed to do that?
I'm not sure I can.
All right, but we'll cut that out. So,
I mean, we can say that. So Dom D'Agostino was going to be on the bill, but then he had a very good reason, work-related reason for why he couldn't come. And we didn't really, he tried very hard to be here and he couldn't be here. So I think some people were very excited to hear him talk, but he's definitely very keen to do a future event. So watch this space and come to Iceland and listen to Dom talk. But then we got a great replacement and it's nice to have some homegrown talent. I think it's really important if you've got a mainly Icelandic audience. And we did have some people come from abroad, but you've got a mainly Icelandic audience. And I think it's important to have an Icelander tell them the same
stuff. There's a real danger of us and theming, right?
Exactly.
All these Americans coming here and telling us, you know, they're kind of, the Icelandic people are sick of that anyway because the Americans came and they set up an airbase where the airport now is and they brought their terrible food and their rubbish cars. And
and but then there's also a little bit of, I know some people have said, well, the problems are so much worse in America, like, is it as much of a problem here? Should we be listening to the Americans because maybe we don't have as much of a problem? I think certainly in certain respects, Iceland is on the same trajectory, just 20 years behind. Mm. So there's definitely the risk of getting there. So maybe we can intervene earlier. Mm. But yeah, hearing that from somebody who is from Iceland and works in Iceland, and she did her PhD in the US, but she's come back and she's working in research here now.
And also a former professional athlete as well. Her bio was very impressive.
Yeah, professional soccer player, fitness competition competitor. So that's in the area of bodybuilding, but more sort of fitness related. And she's been a soccer coach and done a couple of other sports. So yeah, an impressive athlete too, which I think helps speak to...
Ridiculously impressive human all round, and an incredible physical specimen. You know, you see, like, how can this one person be good at all of these things? That doesn't seem fair. Aren't you supposed to be a bit sort of skinny or overweight if you're going to be a nerd? But apparently for her, not. So talk about her presentation.
She talked about two broad things that she has direct research experience in. And the first one was largely to do with metabolic flexibility. So the requirement to have healthy mitochondria and then the ability to be able to both burn carbohydrates and fat at the required time.
I know we've talked about this a lot on the podcast before, but I'm starting to realize it's important to mention things more than once in order to have things sink in. So let's define metabolic flexibility again, because the danger is that people think it means to only burn fat, but that's only a half truth, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of, I think that's part of the problem that we've had with the low carb and ketosis world, is that everybody wants to become fat adapted and a fat burner, but then they don't realize that there's the potential, and it's maybe not as much of a risk as some of the anti-keto people will say it is, but there's a potential that you just focus on the other end of the equation so that you just burn fat rather than thinking about your ability to burn carbohydrate or have that available in certain scenarios, depending on what it is you're trying to achieve. And in reality, you just want to be able to do both, right? You have systems that burn or utilize different energy substrates for different types of work, and you want to be able to do all of those things. And where it came up, and it came up in multiple talks actually, was the ability to burn fat, but mainly just because at nighttime you're supposed to not be eating, and there are periods of time when you will be relying on stored energy, and that, you know, after a certain period of time that's going to have to be fat, and you rely on that to stay alive, right? And you should be able to do that, and being able to do that and spending time doing that, even if it's just a few hours a day, is actually directly linked to metabolic health and longevity. So being able to switch from one to the other, so immediately after a meal, say you're burning the carbohydrates, you know, insulin goes up, increases rates of glycolysis, that becomes the primary fuel source, or you store whatever's extra. And then between meals, you shouldn't be hangry, you shouldn't be necessarily hungry, you have all this stored fat that you can use, and, you know, then you just go the other way and that's what you use. And it's the same if you're doing some kind of aerobic exercise. You know, you should be able to use those stores rather than constantly required to throw down extra fuel down the hatch. So she basically just gave this overview of why you should be able to do both and why that's important, and the importance of, sort of went down into the cell and, you know, talked about what a mitochondria is and why it's important to have healthy mitochondria, and how when you're insulin resistant or you have metabolic disease, you basically have fewer mitochondria and they are crappier mitochondria. So they're worse at doing the job that you want them to do. And then why it's important to think about improving those. And she particularly talked about exercise. She talked about a healthy diet. She didn't really give her own parameters for that. But then she also talked about carnitine, because that's something she's specifically done research in, is the requirement of carnitine both to get energy into the mitochondria, but then also to get excess metabolites out of the mitochondria. You need both. There's a shuttle. So that was something that she's directly done research on. So those were her three key takeaways, were probably a carnitine deficiency in many people, particularly those who get hangry, get sort of energy dips between meals, and then exercise and just, you know, a better diet, so you're not shoving the wrong fuel in the whole time.
And so where's the carnitine coming from?
Oh, red meat.
Okay.
That's where it should come from.
Right. And so it's not necessarily about supplements.
No. And I think she said, based on the work that she's done, that if somebody's been deficient for a long period of time, then you should supplement to get over the hump, and then you can maybe continue to get it from diet. So she did recommend supplements, but only in people who had metabolic issues, not necessarily for everybody. It was, if you're trying to improve your metabolic health, maybe start with some carnitine that can help buffer some of the issues that you're having. And then long term, you obviously don't need it.
I feel like we've been seeing less of the carnitine deficiency on our organic acids test as people have gone off the keto craze, right? So if you're eating a ketogenic diet, you probably should be supplementing with carnitine, because there's almost certainly going to be a deficiency. And that, presumably that's just because you're shuttling more fatty acids into the mitochondria, and perhaps the carnitine supply can't keep up with the demand, perhaps.
That's what it seems to be. It's sort of...
So the prescription is L-carnitine or a few more carbs in your diet, and you can fix the problem.
Yeah, well, I think it's, if you're somebody who is purely going to be relying on the, on those fats as the main energy source, then, you know, making sure that that system is optimized is going to be really important. And, you know, maybe, and I think there's also the thing that people who go onto a ketogenic diet and then take some time, they struggle. It may be that they were carnitine deficient for a time. Anyway, so then part of requirement that you're seeing is a previous deficiency being translated over to a diet where the requirement is higher. And then actually, and then you sort of need to get over that hump. And then maybe in the long term, they don't need it either. But that's sort of, we would see people in the middle period. And then that's definitely when they did need.
Someone should do a keto in a box, like the starter pack that's got the keto mojo meter in. We just found out about this new meter that does glucose and ketones and hemoglobin, which I thought was very cool. Could you imagine a starter pack with that, maybe some electrolytes. And then the L-carnitine as well.
That's probably all you need to get started.
Yeah,
like extra salt with some potassium, magnesium, maybe a bit of selenium, like a nice sort of mineral supplement.
And yeah. Some,
so anybody knows, there's an idea.
Yeah, there's a product for you. Talk about the shuttling the fatty acids in and out of the mitochondria and the movement of acetyl groups, because I'd sort of forgotten about that. You think about carnitine bringing the fatty acid into the mitochondria, but something interesting comes out when you, and that's important.
Yeah, there's this whole concept of protein acetylation that people have probably heard of, because they may have heard of histone acetylation, histone deacetylase inhibitors. So things like a beta-hydroxybutyrate can do it, resveratrol can do it. They sort of, the acetylation, which is basically the adding an acetyl group onto a protein, which can control gene expression. But a lot of acetylation happens by mass action. So if you have a lot of energy, excess energy in the cell, and we've talked about sort of excess or energy overload within the cell, and one of the downstream effects of that is lots of acetyl-CoA, and then you have all these acetyl groups, and then what they do is they end up just like sticking themselves to proteins, and that can almost happen indiscriminately. And one of the potential benefits of fasting is actually you're removing those acetyl groups. So actually you can sort of undo some of that damage. And then at the same time, when you fast, you activate these histone deacetylase, you inhibit histone deacetylases. So you specifically keep on certain acetyl groups that are important. And then you're activating those pathways that we talk about that are important for longevity. So you, maybe mitochondrial biogenesis or some autophagy pathways or something.
So it's part of sensing that low energy state.
Exactly. But what Lilia's research particularly showed is that in that scenario where you have these excess acetyl groups in overnutrition, and this is in mice where they do the high fat diet, so it's high fat, high sugar, kind of like a Western diet equivalent. If you have enough carnitine, you can help get some of those extra acetyl groups out of the mitochondria, but otherwise they sort of hang around inside the mitochondria, and then they just like tag themselves to all the proteins, and it reduces mitochondrial function. So the carnitine is important to get fatty acids in, but it's also important to sort of get out some of those extra acetyl groups if they're there, which can then sort of be tagging themselves to proteins and decreasing their function.
Very interesting. And Lilia did a fantastic job with her presentation. She said at the beginning that she was a bit nervous because she was used to giving presentations to other academics and hadn't really taught the lay public before. And I think she did a really good job, didn't she?
Yeah, she did a great job. And the second thing that she talked about was bone health, because that's something that was a company. She was chief scientific officer of a biotech company here that was developing some bone health supplements based on some of the marine resources that you have in Iceland. And so the main thing she talked about was the load on bones. So if you remove mechanical load, then you lose bone structure. And why that's, you know, so important for bone health is to walk or lift weights or somehow apply stress to your bones such that you get improved bone health. So that sort of came at the end, and that sort of tied into her recommendations to do exercise, because it's, you know, it's important for your mitochondria, but it's also important for your bone health, and both of those are very important for long-term health.
I think that's a good segue into Dr. Doug McGough's talk about the importance of strength training.
So the reason we invited Doug is because he's the populations that he works in, they tend to be very sick. So he has two jobs, right? His day job is he's fighting fires in the emergency department. And then the hobby is that he's helping people improve their long-term health or reduce the likelihood that he's going to see them in the emergency room, but, you know, mainly through high-intensity exercise training. And the way that he does that is through like super slow protocols where you fatigue the slow twitch muscles, and then you end up activating the fast twitch muscles, which are the ones that you lose as you get older and you get sarcopenia. But he does it in a way that you don't have to do it with very, very heavy weights or high intensity, because obviously if you're somebody with multiple sclerosis or Parkinson's disease or severe osteoporosis or severe sarcopenia, you know, putting them under 100 pounds in a squat, I mean, there's just, you know, you're just asking for an injury. But if you do very low weight but extended sets, which eventually become very intense, then you activate those large muscle fibers. That's what you want to keep you upright, stop you from falling over, breaking a hip. That sort of allows you to get that activation without having to do it under very high loads, which can potentially cause injury.
So I'm just wondering how relevant this is for everybody's who's listening, their parents, right? Yeah. So I'm definitely thinking about my parents and the fact that they've never really done any strength training. And as Doug said in his presentation, you're one fall away from death, and they're not really expecting you to die if you were to just slip in the bathroom right there and then. It's what happens once you get into the medical system, once you're in hospital, the chances of you picking up a pneumonia or something like that, that could be deadly to someone in their 70s or 80s.
Yeah, and when you're in your 70s or 80s and you fall and break a hip, I mean, it obviously gets worse the more other things you've got going on, some pre-morbidities, other diseases. But at that age, if you fall and break a hip, your mortality within a year is around 50%. Mm-hmm. So you fall and break a hip, you have 50% chance of dying within the next year because of all those other things. Mm-hmm. And some feedback that I got from my mum, who's sitting in the corner listening to us talking right now, I think the problem with Doug's talk is he assumed, I think, that there were lots of, it was mainly practitioners in the audience. So right. What he did is he gave all the science behind why strength training is important.
Right.
But he didn't tell us about his protocol.
Right.
So then my mum's like, well, this is all very nice and good, but what do I do? So then...
Should we be telling Doug this in private right now?
Maybe we should be telling it. No, but I think it's... So I really enjoyed the talk.
Yeah, I did too. I already know what to do.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Because he thought he was talking to people like us.
Right.
But, you know, maybe we did a bad job of telling him who was in the audience.
So hard, isn't it? I mean, even when you're there in person giving the presentation, you still don't really know who you're talking to. And that's obviously one of the greatest problems with the podcast as well. We don't know who's listening to this. And you may not understand Doug's context, right? He's not really training budding young athletes.
No.
He's dealing with an older population
and seeing fabulous results.
Yeah. It's never too old to see benefit.
So I think
Doug did a really good job of correcting that in the panel afterwards, and he showed us one exercise in particular. Do you want to describe the exercise? I thought it was really good.
Yeah, so I asked him how you can generate, because Rongan had also talked about, he has like a kitchen workout where people are doing like calf raises and presses against the table, and I think that's good, and some lunges, and I think that's good, but I don't think you get that intensity that activates those muscles that you are losing as you get older.
My problem with that was that he was talking about doing calf raises in the kitchen, and he was talking about doing dips. You know, you can have a surface behind you and actually lower your body weight behind you like a dip. But those are teeny tiny muscles, right? Like the tricep and the calf, it's like two of the smallest muscles we've got that can actually do anything like that.
I mean, I think it's good to get people going, but maybe, you know, if you were going for something that's optimal, I'm not sure you're getting the intensity that you require. And that's because the muscle fibers that you lose as you get older are the ones that require that intensity to be activated.
Right.
It's just the nature of the
So those are the stabilizing muscles. When I slip and nearly fall, it's the fast twitch fibers that prevent me from falling.
Yeah, absolutely. So then we asked Doug to kind of show us. So if you don't have any equipment, or like, how do you generate this intensity at home? And so he whipped his belt and he showed three exercises. And the first one was like the chest exercise, where you basically, and his protocol is you start 20 seconds at 50% effort, 20 seconds at 75% effort, 20 seconds at 95% effort, and then 20 seconds at 100% effort, or as long as you can, as 100% effort. And then what you do is you gradually fatigue the type 1 fibers, the endurance fibers first, and then by the end you're just taxing the fast twitch fibers, but you're doing it isometrically, so you're not actually moving at all. So like the chest exercise is just by pressing your hands together. If you press your hands together right now, you can feel you activate your chest muscles,
right?
So you do that, so you just press 50%, 75%, 95%, 100%. And then he did like a shoulder based exercise where he took his belt off and he sort of gripped it in front of him, held it in his hands, and then just like tried to pull the belt apart long ways.
So the force was coming from his arms. Maybe I was doing that wrong. I tried that the next day with a towel, right? So this is maybe a great thing that you can do if you're away traveling.
You can just do it with a towel, yeah.
Just do it with a towel. But I was treating it like a deadlift. So I was like trying to generate the force.
So that's the other one.
Okay.
Yeah, so the first one he did was the shoulder-based one.
Oh,
and
sorry.
And then afterwards he held one end of the belt in each hand, and then he looped it under his feet like he was coming down for a deadlift. And I'm doing it right now. I'm not sure why, because I don't have a belt in my hand. But
and people can't see you.
And people can't see me. But he sort of looped it under his hand, and then he was kind of in the sort of like half deadlift, half squat position. And right. The idea is you just try and stand up at 50%, 75%, 95%, 100% effort.
Same principle. So you're fatiguing those slow twitch muscle fibers first, and then you move on to the fast twitches, which is what we're aiming for.
And to be honest, if you did only one thing, that exercise would literally do all of it, because you've done all the back, glutes, quads, and you're also doing your grip and grip strength, because you're having to grip onto the belt. And grip strength is one of the best predictors of all-cause mortality. And it also applies to everybody. So it applies, you know, you can't necessarily test. So leg strength is another one, but you can't test leg strength in somebody who's bedbound or has really bad arthritis or has some other comorbidities, but you can test how hard they can squeeze. And then it's also grip strength exercises are also helpful for those people. And if grip is the only thing that they can test, you know, you can just squeeze a ball, and even that will improve health outcomes.
Right.
So the grip is something that's applicable to everybody.
Right.
But if you're training your grip, back, glutes, and quads, I mean, you don't really need anything else. Like if you only did one exercise, you could do just that and you would probably, you know, do pretty well.
Brilliant. It's very practical, very important work.
And it requires nothing except for something you can loop under your feet and grip onto, like a towel. A towel will be fine, or a belt.
Exactly. You can find that anywhere, no matter where you are. Really awesome. Let's talk about Sachin Panda. I really, really enjoyed Sachin Panda.
Yeah, his he was one of the first people that I thought of when we were talking about this conference, actually. And I think I just watched a YouTube video of his describing his work. And he's just, you know, such a humble, clever, nice, engaging guy.
Yeah.
He's been doing this stuff for so long. And like, finally, people are, I guess, finally people are listening to him.
Listening to him,
which
noticing.
Is amazing. And you know, one thing that I think everybody noticed, and Brian Walsh was sat next to me, and like halfway through, like just seeing how professionals like his slides were, like everything was a custom graphic that showed you exactly what it was he was talking about, but also made it make perfect sense. And it was just something, you know, for the visual learners, it wasn't like loads of extra text or anything like that. It was just sort of like,
there was barely any words on any of his slides.
No words whatsoever. It was all like very visual. And Brian was like, oh God, this guy is such a badass. He just like moved over and said it. And it's like the slides were just amazing.
Is that a result of him being a senior academic that's done a lot of important work, and he has people that produce beautiful presentations for him now?
Well, I don't know, because most senior academics who've done a lot of important work couldn't make a PowerPoint presentation if it like would save their life. So
he didn't produce that. That's what I'm saying.
Oh no. So I mean, some places have like a graphics department where somebody, I think that quality of presentation, I think, is still fairly rare.
Okay. Right? Okay. People think of him as the time restricted eating guy, but really he's the circadian rhythm guy.
Yeah. But he has focused on food, because he did talk about sleep and he talked about light. His point was, the reason why they focused on food is because the light environment that most people are exposed to, which they can't change, it's hard to change. Maybe that's something that's more difficult to intervene. And then also sleep, if you're stressed and you have family and job and all this stuff, night shift workers or whatever, it's also hard to change sleeping patterns. Or in some people, it's hard to change sleeping patterns. But when you eat is something that everybody should have control over. Mm-hmm. So he focused on the easiest intervention point. So that's where he's done most of his research. So he definitely said that all of it was important, but he's focused on food just because that's something that he knows most people are most likely to be able to change.
Mm-hmm. And he's done some really clever experiments where they're using an app so they can work with humans remotely rather than trying to bring them into a metabolic ward or anything completely expensive and bonkers like that. And so talk about some of the experiments he's done.
Well, I guess it all started in mice, where he's done like every permutation of different quality of diet from, you know, I think they've done low carb, high carb, standard chow, Western diet, all these different things, and then looked at the effect of just shortening the feeding window. And he's done it like literally whether you eat for 9 hours a day, 10 hours a day, 11 hours a day, 12 hours a day. Like,
is that, what's the shortest window he's looked at?
8 hours, I think.
Okay. And is there any reason he hasn't gone shorter?
I don't know. You'd have to ask him. I haven't seen him. What, you know, I think he's sort of, that's where they've seen the most benefit. I don't know if they've tried shorter and just not seen any extra benefit. That's perfectly possible. So I don't know. But if you look at some of the human research, it does suggest that if you like have just one meal a day, that may actually not be as good as having a couple or two or three in terms of like blood sugar control or insulin.
Right,
you know, blood sugar or insulin responses to a meal tend to be exacerbated or maybe worsened depending on how many meals a day you're having and what time of day. So
it's probably going to end up being extreme calorie restriction is my guess. Most people can't eat 2,000 calories in one sitting unless you're using something that's very, very good at delivering calories, like a liquid perhaps.
And then you're not getting any of the nutrition that you need. So I think part of it is practical application, right? So most people don't want to just eat one meal a day, right? Or they don't, you know, so he's sort of creating stuff that's going to be the most applicable to the most people. And so then what comes out of it is that in mice and then also in humans, regardless of what you eat, if you can shorten the eating window, then metabolic health improves and weight decreases. Mm-hmm. In the mice, they eat the same amount of calories in a shorter time period and they gain a lot less weight and they live longer. But in humans, if you restrict their feeding window, they automatically restrict their calorie intake because it's just hard to eat that many calories in a short period of time.
Right.
And the way he's done the so his app, you basically you take a photo of your food and then it gets sent to a central server and actually deletes it from your phone. So you can't go back and look back at what you ate and thought, oh God, I ate terribly today.
Yeah.
You know, you just send it and it disappears. You don't think about it again. But then it tags the time that you ate it. And then they later on calculate calories and all that kind of stuff for you. So you don't have to do it. But what you see is that after sort of 6 p.m., that's when people eat their most calorie dense foods. So it's sort of the late night eating, which they're getting rid of, is also
the worst type of eating. You run out of willpower. It's the end of the day. You're kind of tired. You can't be asked to cook anything. There's some Pringles there in the cupboards and a pint of ice cream in the freezer. I'm going to sit down and watch the TV and eat all of this stuff. And people lie, right? When you ask them about what did you eat and when did you eat it, the quality of the data is very poor. But when you do the app, the quality is very, very good, right? You can't really lie about what time you took a photograph.
Yeah, but I think that's one of the reasons why it's so applicable to the average person is that if you just say, well, I'm going to stop eating at 6 p.m., say, then you've removed that time period where you're most likely to say, oh, I'll just have a bowl of ice cream or, you know, I'll just eat those Pringles in the cupboard or, you know, I'll have a couple of glasses of wine. And so you automatically improve the quality of the diet and you, reduce that sort of calorie dense, nutrient free component of the diet. And then you add a circadian timing component and literally all you've done is tell them to eat their calories in a shorter part of the day, right? So you give one piece of advice and you've already improved three or four different things.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And Katie Compton, who was on the podcast recently, talked about using the app and she's had really great results with it and continues to use it, even though she may not be part of the experiment anymore. So I'll link to the app in the show notes. I make comprehensive show notes for each episode and there's a time map, time stamped list of things that I'll mention in the podcast. And so you can find the links in the show notes. Okay, so moving on.
I'm not going to move on yet because there are two really important things that Sachin said that I think are really worth talking about.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So the first one is that in the absence of good light cues, and he made a great point, which is that during the day, we're not exposed to enough light and at night, we're exposed to too much light. And we've talked about that on the podcast before. And he has an app called My Lux. And so your iPhone can measure how many lux you're being exposed to. And so we were sat in this hall and it was brightly lit and there was, you know, a big screen, all this stuff. And it was like 20 lux in the middle of the day when what you need to be exposed to is 10,000 lux.
Right.
So like you think, oh, there's actually plenty of light in here, but compared to what you need to set your rhythm is actually...
You've got to go outside.
You've got to go outside. And he was saying, so in the absence of proper light cues, food timing becomes that much more important. Mm. So for everybody, again, in the Western world, if you create a circadian food rhythm, then some of the absence of real lighting cues, light and dark, potentially become less important. Obviously, if you had both, that would be great. But I think it's most important for the people that he's working with, if he's working with people with obesity who are in this sort of modern light environment, then if you can create that circadian component, you've automatically made, again, so many more things better because you're helping to entrain the clocks when they've sort of been lost. Mm. So in people who have circadian rhythm issues, then food becomes really important. And we were talking about, you know, separately and hypothesized that maybe people with things like seasonal affective disorder who really are affected by light, you know, maybe for them, if they could create a stronger circadian cue from their food, you know, maybe that will help combat some of those symptoms. Mm. And that was our own sort of hypothesis. Mm. Don't know whether it's true, but that's definitely a possibility. And then the other thing that he said, which I thought was really interesting and is about caloric restriction and all the caloric restriction studies, you know, there's still debate about, well, there should be debate. And some people say, well, it's definite, you know, caloric restriction will make us live longer, and we should just all be restricting our calories, and that then we'll all be happier and healthier for longer. Which, if you look at the way the studies are done, there are lots of potential issues. But the one that he pointed out was that if you're trying to create a caloric restriction, you automatically include, or you create, a circadian timing component. Because, so say you want a mouse to only eat a certain amount of food, you just give it that food, and then it eats all that food in one go, and then there's no food left. So right. You've created a restricted feeding window.
Right.
And it's the same thing, so say in humans, if they're told to calorically restrict, so something like the calorie trial in humans or some of the trials in monkeys, if you have less food to eat, it's just going to take you less time to eat it. Right. You're not going to just like...
You run out of food in the evening.
Yeah, you run out of food in the evening, or you skip a meal because, you know, you just don't, you only have so much food. And so you've already created a circadian timing component. So well, maybe it's not the caloric restriction. Maybe it's because you created a circadian component to the diet. I was like, oh, this is amazing. Like, so yeah. I thought that was a really brilliant insight that I hadn't thought about before.
Yeah, that's incredible. We've been traveling around Europe for the last few weeks, and I've seen almost no environment that is in concordance with Sachin's work, right? Everybody has got these super bright spotlights embedded in their ceiling. And then as soon as it gets dark, the lights come on.
Yeah.
Why is this not? I mean, so Sachin mentioned this, that they may end up changing building codes.
Yeah.
Right. So when you build a new building, you're required to put a certain amount of glass in. Glass can be used as a structural component of a building now. So we could put more glass in, get more light into the space during the day. And then, of course, if we can come up with a device like the iPhone 7, can we come up with a switch that when you flick it, it changes the temperature of the light according to the time of day? And of course, that would be completely trivial.
Yeah.
So and more startup opportunities. Like, who's doing this? You know of a company that's doing this?
So there are some lighting companies, but I think it's mainly that just the temperature of the bulb is different, and you use different temperatures in different rooms. So Ben Greenfield talked about this, how he has like the red bulb in his bedroom, and then he has the white bulbs that have a blue component.
Yeah, you can definitely engineer it. You can hack it. I mean, the orange bulbs are available on Amazon.com and pretty much anywhere where they sell light bulbs.
But what you need is just efflux for your house, where it's like reaches a certain time of day, and then regardless of what you want, it makes everything go orange. And
yeah. Exactly. Or the orange glasses as well, but they're so dorky and I'm not sure they work. Like the ones I've got, I think a lot of light comes around the sides.
Yeah.
And I look like an idiot.
Which ones are they?
I don't know. I just got them from sunglasseswarehouse.com or something that costs $9. So maybe not the best. So yeah, really, really important work. And yeah, I really wished I'd said hello to Sachin now and asked him to come onto the podcast to clear up some of these things. And I should have told him about the fact that Katie Compton, 13 times national cyclocross champion, is using his app. And...
Oh, I've got, I mean, I emailed him to get him to the conference first, and I emailed him, I emailed him cold, and he replied directly to me. So
yeah,
I'm sure we can arrange that.
That is still a vice of mine. Like, how is it that I can be the first person to say hello when I go out to walk the dog and talk to a total stranger? But when I get the opportunity to talk to someone like Sachin, I let it slip. I don't know why I do that. It's a mistake. Well, let's talk about Ben Greenfield then. Ben was, I think he did a really good job of trying to condense down. So anyone that listens to the Ben Greenfield podcast, I'm sure there's lots of people that listen to this podcast that do, will know that it's a fire hose of information.
Yeah.
Each episode is so many things. Like, how could you possibly be doing it all? And I think recently I've decided that really Ben's audience are about novelty, right? He's an ideas guy. Like, listen to the Ben Greenfield. And people love novelty, right? That's a really good strategy in business. Novelty is something that people seek out. And so lots of novelty, lots of new things each week. You can't possibly do it all. You really need to prioritize and decide which are the most important things. And then for Ben to stand up on stage and do that after doing however many episodes, what is it, like probably nearly 1,000 episodes of the Ben Greenfield podcast at this point? So what do you talk about, you know, after all these years and so many episodes? And I think he did a really good job of condensing it down.
Yes, I think the way that he did it, and I think which has to be the way to do it, is the stuff that he basically told us about, the stuff that he does.
Right.
So
right.
There's only, you know, even for him, there's only so many things that a man can do.
Right.
And yes, you know, some of the stuff that he talked about in terms of electrical shielding from Wi-Fi and structuring his water and stuff, I'm sure like most of the audience, their eyes just glazed over and they ignored him. But, you know, he started with movement and some of the protocols, you know, based on the research, that doing something, you know, high intensity, some strength training, some aerobic training, doing those once a week, like gave some sort of simple structured advice of how people could do those things. And that sort of movement, so you cover everything in a week, you know, so that was kind of pretty nice and simple, you know. And then he talked about nutrient dense food and how there's lots of different things we could do. So we, like he mentioned everything from vegan diets to paleo diets to all these other iterations. He was like, I'm completely agnostic about diet. And I thought that was pretty good, because it was just like, you know, here are the principles. So the things he focuses on are, you know, whether it's digestible and whether it's nutrient dense. If it's nutrient dense but not digestible, maybe there's a way to make it digestible. And if it's digestible but not nutrient dense, then you're into the realm of the Western foods that maybe we should be avoiding. So I thought the rules were fairly easy to understand, and that sort of gave people a good grounding. And that was sort of, again, going back to the pillars that Rongan was talking about, sort of tied right back into those, and they largely agreed. So I think that was kind of like a nice, gave a little bit more detail, or gave the message in a slightly different way that people could maybe understand, or would identify with.
I really enjoyed the idea of a dumb home. It was quite fun. But now when I think about it, we don't really need the dumb. So when Ben said the dumb home, it means I've got no Wi-Fi. You know, there's no technology that
Alexa or...
Right, no Bluetooth. You can't order more toilet roll by Bluetooth and all of that. But that is hilarious. I don't believe it.
Is that an Alexa?
There is an Alexa in the room as we're recording this podcast. And when I said that, the Alexa started speaking.
Alexa, turn yourself off.
That's amazing. Tommy's just unplugged it. That is so funny.
I didn't know that was there.
But yeah, we don't really need a dumb home. What we really need is the science interpreting and it implemented correctly, right? So the feature I just talked about where the color, the lighting is changing according to the time of day.
Yeah.
I mean, you just need to be, that's kind of smart features, like smarter than a conventional light switch and a light bulb. It just needs to be done right. It doesn't need to be dumb.
Yeah. And I think if then he talked about all the, you know, the different lights he has in different rooms. And that's, whereas if he was applying his true, like, stupid home principles, he would have everything open air, everything. You would get natural daylight through just windows during the day. And then at night, there'd be no lights because it would be dark. And so, you know, I think you're right that even he would be forced to admit that he does use the best of technology, and that's what he talks about. So I think the idea is nice, and it's that you don't need to automate or make everything in your home smart, but equally at the same time, you could make things smarter that would create a more natural environment through the correct use of technology.
I do think he was in danger of creating more of that us and theming, you know, like, it's all very well for you, Ben, in your mansion in the Spokane,
Washington. Mansion without however many millions of dollars or whatever.
Yeah, you could just spend the whole day meditating and flipping tires, whereas I'm an emergency room doctor and I work night shift.
Yeah, I mean, he did sort of give some of the basic principles that I think help too. So it's kind of a, you can start wherever you want on this path and do the easier stuff first. And if you want to do some of this other stuff, then sort of open the door to some of those things too.
Shall we talk about Brian?
Yeah. So
I think we've satisfied the criteria that no podcast shall be recorded without mentioning Brian Walsh's name. And justifiably so too. Brian's fantastic. We love him to pieces. And he's as good live as he is teaching via video or recording podcasts.
I do actually think he's better live.
You really?
Yeah. So this is the first time I met him in person.
Okay.
And I mean, that's not saying that he's not good in the other formats. I just enjoyed him in person even more. And so last year when I gave a talk at the Icelandic Health Symposium, part of my talk, so the last year we focused largely on foods. Then I talked about all the other stuff that's important. And one of those things was social isolation. And I stole Brian's story. And I won't tell it here because if you haven't heard it, you should go back
and listen. I'll link to the podcast with Brian where
go and listen to him telling that story. But then I thought he would be a perfect person to come and
let's hear it from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, exactly. And he went through several different things that he wanted to talk about, like why taking antioxidants doesn't actually make you live longer, some other stuff. But then what he came up with was, it was called the science of thought-driven physiology. So how your thoughts can actually change what's going on in your body. So we've talked, I mean, Ellen Langer's been on the podcast. We've talked about Ellen Langer's research. She's been in highlights emails too. You know, studies like the perceived time has an effect on glucose levels more than actual time that's passed. Mm. Or how if you tell hotel chambermaids that by the way, did you know that when you spend all day walking up and down hotels, changing beds, hoovering, you're actually doing what we would consider good exercise. And then if you tell them that, they suddenly lose weight without changing anything else. And their blood pressure improves and their blood glucose improves and all this stuff improves. And they've literally done nothing other than realize that actually, you know, I'm actually pretty active, you know, I'm in shape. And then there was another study where they took women with like a true amenorrhea. So, you know, their hypothalamus isn't talking to their ovaries in the way to create a normal menstrual cycle. And then they gave them cognitive behavioral therapy to change the way they think about their condition. And then their cycles returned with changes in estrogen and progesterone. And all they did was get a psychological therapy. So just based on how your mind approaches things, you can actually change hormone levels in your body. Mm-hmm. And then he was like, wait, what supplement did they take?
Yeah. Where was the medicine? So where they actually showed data, a time series mapping out the cycle, and you could actually see where the intervention was. And the intervention, you think it's going to be a drug because of the effect it has on estradiol. And it's not. It's cognitive behavioral therapy.
And then he talked about perception. So like how you perceive things and your attitude towards them, and then how that affects outcomes too. So my favorite one was, you know, in people who have a positive, who think about aging as a positive thing, you know, it's like, I'm getting older, you know, that's actually probably, you know, not such a bad thing. You know, I've gained wisdom. I've lived this great life and it's okay to get older. They actually live longer and healthier than people who are scared of aging. And I thought that was really ironic, because essentially the people there in the audience are there to all figure out how to live longer, probably because they don't like the idea of aging, yet they're being told that if they were thinking positively about aging, then they might actually age more slowly or live longer. So it's kind of like this strange reverse psychology or whatever.
Right.
This inverse thought process. So I thought that was really interesting. And so like he was on stage like, I'm slightly fat, balding, wrinkly. I'm really happy about it. You know, that's okay. Yeah. I don't mind. And so like that was just like a really good example.
I think it was Ken Ford was the first person I heard say this. Maybe the only person I've heard say this is that aging is good because what's the alternative?
Death.
Right? So yeah, why not be positive about it? It's funny because some of what Brian talks about and some of the research that he presents is intuitive. It seems like common sense, like what you think is going to be the outcome will have an effect on the outcome.
Yeah.
But then what's surprising is when you show the physiological data and you see that hormones are going up and down and real things are changing in physiology. That's the part that's surprising to me. And I'll give you some examples, actually, with restaurants now. If I think I'm going to be glutenized, then just the stress of sitting there and thinking, I don't think that chef's going to use a separate pan for my burger is going to, I might as well not eat at that point because, this, you know, I'm going to have a bad outcome, whatever I think. And I've been thinking about this as well for people that may be worried about chemicals they're exposed to, you know, when they walk into a new house and it sort of smells like new paint and, oh, I don't like the Wi-Fi in here. And the most toxic environment of all is the exit through the duty-free shop in the airport, right? And you look up and you see all these bundles of cables going through the metal cages. So you're basically inside of a Faraday cage with all these cables inside of the Faraday cage.
And then all these
cage.
Chemicals off-gassing from all of the things you're walking past.
It's extraordinary. Like we've got to the point now where we basically hold our nose and just sprint as we go through the duty-free shop. And you know, if you've got to the point where you're expecting that to have a negative impact on your health, guess what? It will. And so that's why it doesn't bother anyone else. It's because they're just not really noticing it in the same way.
So then you kind of wonder whether the fact that you spend all this time thinking and talking about this stuff is actually having, maybe ignorance is bliss and we should just quit and go and live in the woods.
Well, so I had a conversation with Brian in the back of a car on the way to the speaker's dinner at the Blue Lagoon. And he wants me to talk more about this. What is health? Like, is what you're doing at this point helping people by making them constantly thinking about how they can improve their health? Are you really still improving it? Or did they already achieve optimum health and now they just need to chill out and forget about it?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm perfectly open to that idea.
And I think that's a huge part of the people that we interact with, actually, that they would probably be healthier and happier if they just stopped worrying about it.
Mm.
And I mean, it is something that I try and do myself, because having a lot of not information can be a very dangerous thing. And you know that people sort of obsess about all these details. And I try and go the opposite way. So like I've informed myself, I know what the risks are. Like I know it's probably not a great idea that I'm standing next to a Wi-Fi router right now. But I also know that worrying about it is going to be a bigger problem than the act of standing next to it. So I know it, I've acknowledged it, but there's nothing I can do about it now, so I don't really worry about it. And I think there's definitely that last step is something that more people need to be doing. Mm. You know, you can educate yourself, you can modify the things that you can modify, are willing to modify, that you're willing to get stressed about, willing to make a change. And then if there's anything else that's extra, worrying about it is all you're going to be left with is worrying about it. And that's only going to make things worse. Then just don't worry about it. Don't think about it. It's not something you're going to change, not something you can change. So it's better to actually go the opposite way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I become increasingly interested, though, in ways in which you can maybe harness the power of this positivity. Like, how can I, is there a button I can press and just have the correct mindset? Wouldn't that be fantastic?
Well, that's the next app you can create.
We should probably talk briefly about the difference between hedonism and eudaimonia, because that was a very interesting point that came up in Brian's presentation. I think I might have this down and better than he does, honestly. Like his slide on that, I think it was a little bit difficult to understand it. Whereas in my mind, it's quite simple. So hedonism is the pursuit of pleasure for oneself, and it happens very quickly. So it's instant gratification. So a drug user snorting a line of cocaine is hedonism, right? Mm. And then you've got to do more to get that same effect. Whereas eudaimonia is pleasure that's complex and delayed and always achieved through something else. It doesn't necessarily have to be someone else. You might achieve pleasure by looking after a plant or an animal or just something else. It's not that instant gratification. Whereas his slide on that, I thought, was kind of confused. Well, what did you think?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I didn't actually even read his slide, but I thought his example was actually okay, because he gave the example of himself going on stage, and the hedonistic version is, please let me be really clever today and say all the right stuff. And the eudaimonic version is, please let the audience get what they need to out of this talk. Right. And the end goal, what happens, may be exactly the same thing, but it's the way you approach it. So even though I can't remember what the slide said because I didn't pay any attention to it because I was just listening to what he was talking about.
It's really, so especially eudaimonia, it's a very nebulous concept. And the more you speak, the less clear it becomes. And so adding more bubbles, like more bullet points under the eudaimonia column, it doesn't necessarily make it any clearer. But yeah, the example you just gave, I think, illustrates the point perfectly. And so talk about why it might be important.
So, I mean, that particular comparison goes back again to some of the stuff he touches on in the social isolation podcast, but it's basically to do with having a purpose for the greater good. And that's what a lot of his talk on the day, and then also the day after when he spoke at the practitioner event, he came down, you know, talking about the science of purpose and the effect that has on health. And so even if you are a socially isolated smoker with multiple diseases, if you have a purpose in life, your mortality, actually your long-term health is, or when you die, you will live longer just through the act of having a purpose, despite the fact that all these other things go against you. So even if you are socially isolated, if you have a purpose, you're actually protected. And there are all these other things that he's now built into his clinic, you know, asking people, why do you wake up in the morning? And his example is, if I smacked you across the face in the middle of the night and woke you up and said, what's your purpose? Would you have an answer? Mm-hmm. And I guess it's really difficult to tell whether I would have an answer.
Yeah, so what's your answer, Tommy?
If you did that to me, I'd just punch you and go back to sleep.
Which is what Brian said most people would do that don't have a purpose. So you're trying to tell me that you don't have a purpose.
No, I do have a purpose. But
what is your purpose?
I think I was actually asked this. I was having this conversation with Elizabeth the other day, and the only way I can boil it down is to say that I want to make as many people as healthy as possible.
Right.
And that's literally it. And I couldn't tell you in 5 years' time how I'll be doing that. Yeah. I honestly couldn't. Yeah. Maybe Nourish Balance Thrive won't exist anymore. Maybe we'll have had an argument and you're off telling people to eat a vegan diet and we've reached, you know, artistic differences. It's perfectly possible. And then I'll hopefully find another way to do it. But sort of that's essentially what it boils down to. And how I do that, I think, will probably change.
A
few times along the way.
Yeah. I mean, so I think the right biological answer is we're all here to reproduce, aren't we? That's I've just got to pass on my DNA and then I'm done. And Brian did say that too, is that his purpose is really his family, but that's kind of a cheating answer, isn't it? It's like, of course, your purpose is your family. And I would give the same answer, although my wife, who's in this room, would probably going to rush up and say, I'm going to disagree with you there and say that the things that you find on the laptop are far more important than anything that's happening with our daughter. But yeah, I disagree. But yeah, no, my purpose, I think, is even more generic than health. I just love solving problems. That's the most gratifying thing for me is solving a problem. So, you know, that may be something in computer science. It may be something, at the moment, it's all about health. And it seems like some of the most interesting problems that we could solve are in health at the moment. Like, who really cares about what's going on in finance or in social media or some other industry? All the interesting problems are in health, in my opinion. Yeah. So, yeah, for me, it's
but maybe it's all once about you've solved all of them, then you'll be going and fixing social media.
I think I'm going to be long dead and married before they've solved all the problems in health. I think we've got our work cut out there. Okay. So Brian was great. The next day, while we're talking about Brian, he came to the practitioner workshop that happened the next day. And then he Ben Greenfielded them, didn't he? He hit them with the fire hose. He started with the levels of organization and he talked about the importance of cellular function and he built the whole thing up from first principles. And he talked about the periodic table. And then he talked about all the importance of all the different micronutrients that are required as cofactors to make all these enzymes work. And without those, we're all completely screwed and everybody's drawn towards all these fancy supplements these days. And the standing joke that ran throughout his talk was goji berries. Does this guy have a goji berry deficiency? No, it's B6. That's the thing that you really need.
Or does
need
he have
to
a hormetea deficiency?
Hormetea deficiency. Yes, he does. First thing in the morning, I do have a hormetea deficiency. That's why I reach for the hormetea every morning. I totally agree with him. So
his principles were that every disease is just based on the dysfunction of a cell.
Right.
A certain type of cell in a certain tissue. And what then causes cellular dysfunction, or what you need to ensure optimal cellular function, and it often comes down to that cell's ability to produce the energy that it needs to do the job that it wants to do. Mm. And it's, you know, so in order to optimize that, you need to give the cell everything it needs to do to perform that job. Mm-hmm. You need to remove anything that might damage that cell, and you need to put that cell in the right environment.
Right.
And, you know, that obviously makes perfect sense. So then you need to give it all the right micronutrients. You need to deliver it with glucose, particularly glucose is very important, and the inability to do that, you know, causes real problems. It needs to be able to get that glucose in and utilize it, you know, everything associated with that. But then you also need to remove anything that could be, you know, some kind of chronic infection or a heavy metal or a xenobiotic, something else that might be disrupting the function of that cell. And then you need to put it in the right environment. So you need to optimize the pH. And he talked about the vast number of things that your body does to buffer pH to make sure that stays the same. And the reason you do that is to maintain enzyme function because, you know, those are very strict, the range that they work in optimally. And then you also need to have those cells surrounded by other cells of the same type and have them be able to communicate with one another. And then that's where the sort of the communication and the purpose, you know, the cell has a purpose. And then also the human has a purpose and then the population has a purpose. And he's sort of like, well, maybe, you know, if you lack purpose as a human, then your cells kind of read that and then they lack purpose.
Yeah. And we actually see this in the literature. You've talked about this in the highlight series. So if you don't know about our highlight series, come to nourishbalancethrive.com/highlights and we'll send you, or you'll send you this narrative on some studies that have been done with testosterone and your partner's level of testosterone. That has gone into the highlight series, hasn't it? Or does it have to go in now that I've said it?
No. So are you talking about the study whereby men who are in committed relationships have lower testosterone because that makes them better able, you know, so then they're less likely to be aggressive and out there competing and fighting, and they're more likely to be caring towards their family. And so, you know, we have all these people who are like, everything's going to be terrible until my testosterone is 1,000.
Right.
I'm like, well, what's going to happen when your testosterone's 1,000? You know, why does it need to be that high? Do you realize that actually there are some benefits to maybe it not being that high? And yes,
the trouble with testosterone. No, so that is absolutely fascinating stuff. But what I was referring to is that nothing kills the moment like your partner not wanting it. Right?
Yeah.
So it's not just about your levels of testosterone that's going to lead to increased sexual performance, say, but also the other people who are in that same equation, right? Like that's important too. And so it's not just the levels of organization. It's not just about, you know, the cell and then the tissue and the organ and the body system and all, the whole organism. It extends beyond that to other organisms and then populations and communities and or tribes or whatever you want to call it. It's super interesting the way things work.
I guess the way we describe it, maybe it sounded like Brian was being sort of a little bit woo-woo, but actually, you know, I have a number of papers that kind of show how each of this happens at each level. And maybe because we know that thoughts can drive physiology, you know, if you don't have a reason for your body to be there to do something in the wider community, maybe the body inside on a cellular level is like, well, fuck it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't need to perform our job as well as we could do because there's what are we performing that job for? I don't really know.
Yeah, absolutely. Brian is extremely evidence-driven and he's almost giving us tons of studies to look at. It's kind of his favorite things at the moment, isn't it? It's just to sit in a cupboard for 6 months and pull out, emerge with all these studies that come up with this grand picture that's very, very important. And he did a really good job of introducing people to blood chemistry. I agree with Brian, actually, that blood chemistry is the most important test. It's the one that everybody has access to. It's relatively inexpensive. whether or not you can afford to do our $8,500 program is neither here nor there. You should have access to blood chemistry no matter where you are. And there's some really, really important information on there that perhaps is being overlooked. Right?
Oh, yeah.
People are not extracting as much information as they possibly could. And I'm working on it. We're going to produce some software. But it's interesting because you could actually uncover some nutritional deficiencies that are very fixable with inexpensive supplements or changes to your diet just from doing a CBC, right? Just looking at the anemia panel, like diagnosing the cause of an anemia could easily reveal a nutritional deficiency.
And maybe you need to start with the fact that it's not even an anemia. So it's by the time you're in the bottom half of the normal range,
right?
You know, so you start with the fact that people who's, so say, I think it's men. So the optimal ranges that we use are men above 14 mm-hmm. and women above 12.5, right? Mm-hmm. And if, so the normal range from the lab extend lower than that. But if you look at the literature and you look at, say, all-cause mortality and certain disease risk starts to increase as you go below, say, mm-hmm. 14 in men, right? So then you know that the optimal range is probably going to be close to 14. So then if you start with that, anything below that is a potential issue. And then if you look at all the different patterns in the iron studies and the size of the red blood cell, the red, you know, the variability of the size of the red blood cell mm-hmm. and various other factors, you can identify 5 or 6 different basic nutritional deficiencies. Could be iron, zinc, copper, B6. And just from that, you know, for like a blood test that costs a few dollars, a few pounds, you know, wherever you are, you can get it from your GP in the UK. They'll run you like a whole blood count. You know,
right.
You know, if it looks like you have an iron deficiency anemia, but your neutrophils are low, maybe it's actually a copper deficiency. And then you mm-hmm. can't actually access the iron that you're eating because you need copper to activate the enzymes to activate the iron and you absorb it and use it properly. So we can extract so much more data from that. And
right. But you need the software in order to do it, right?
Yeah.
So I feel like I've just had some clarity over what I need to do with this software. And it's like the anemia panel, I think that's what it is. And it's a decision table. When you look at Brian's work, there's matrix of markers in one column. And then there's the up and down arrows that form the cells of the matrix. But really, we don't want to make it binary. We want to put ranges in the decision table, and then we can relate that to what we've seen in the epidemiological data. Is it epidemiological?
Yeah, most of it's epidemiological. Yeah.
Exactly. So they're looking at all-cause mortality based on the...
So it's difficult to like, you can't do it. It's difficult to do. I mean, some of it's prospective too. So you measure somebody's ranges and then see how long they live.
Right.
But you can't just like make somebody slightly anemic for a long period of time and see whether they die sooner.
Right.
So a lot of it has to come from population-based data rather than controlled trials. But that's just the nature of the beast.
Awesome. And I'll link to Brian's new course on glucose, which is very good. I finished it a couple of weeks ago and it's excellent. And Brian is working on level 2 of Metabolic Fitness Pro. And we are in no way financially affiliated with him.
No, we just love him.
Yeah, we just love him. And that's the only reason.
Yeah, I told him that on stage because he said it's really important to tell people you love them. So I was like, at that moment in time, I was very much in love with Brian. Well, I guess I am a lot of the time.
So just one last but not least, Diana Rogers.
Yeah, and I really did envy her because she had to come on stage after Brian. And he was just so enthusiastic and so...
Had a stage presence.
He had such a stage presence. And that doesn't detract from the job that she did, which was great. But it was just, I felt like he's just a hard act to follow, I guess.
Right.
It's just
like Gary Tarbes.
Yeah.
Who spoke for an hour and a half without breathing.
Yeah, last year. And so she talked about, and which is something that is incredibly important, which is if we're arrogant enough to believe that we can halts the process of aging to keep people alive for much longer, and we have the population of the earth that we currently have and the way we are currently approaching the planet's resources, is there any way to sustainably keep this many people alive healthily on the planet? I don't think the answer is, I don't think we can. But what, so part of the puzzle of longevity is sustainability and finding a way. So if you keep all these people alive, you need to feed them. Mm. And then what's the most sustainable way to feed them? And obviously Diana Rogers is big in the paleo community. She works on a farm. She's a nutritionist and she looks into sustainability issues of plant-based versus animal-based agriculture. And, you know, she showed quite nicely, I think because of the recent, there's been this, you know, recent interest in lab grown meat. So you can grow meat in the lab. It's not associated with the ethical problems, potential ethical problems of raising animals. And she did say up front, you know, I don't believe in factory farming. I believe, you know, our animals should be outside roaming the land that they're designed to roam on. And a big part of that is the fact that 70% of the world's land mass is unsuitable for the growth of crops. So if you come to Iceland, how much wheat can you grow on lava fields and moss? Very little. How many sheep can you grow? A lot.
Right.
And so those sheep take food, plants that humans can't eat, and on land where humans couldn't grow something else, and they turn it into food.
Right.
And there's this big debate about how we should just be farming soy and grains, and, you know, that's going to be better for the environment and less bad for animals. But actually, there's only so much of the world where you can actually do that. And in terms of the natural resources, if you have animals grazing on the land actually is healthier because you're keeping them under control. You're keeping the plants under control. And then you also have something to keep the animals under control so that they don't overeat the plants, and the things keeping the livestock under control could be us.
Right.
As well as other things that you need in an ecosystem. And so then that area of land is healthier because it has animals grazing on it. And then we keep those animals in check because we're eating them. But then the resources that are required to feed those animals are free. They're free rain, free sunlight, which then creates free grass for them to eat.
Right.
And if you do that properly, and I guess that a lot of that comes from work with the Savory, you know, Alan Savory is doing a lot of, you know, similar work and actually showing that if you do this properly and sustainably, you can then create this food with minimal impact on the environment compared to, say, monocropping with soy, which just completely destroys any diversity, destroys the soil, requires continuous input of fossil fuel derived fertilizers and all these other things. And it's actually something very similar for lab-based meat. You know, you want to create lab-based meat on a scale, you know, the amount of energy and then the initial starting resources that you need to have the first products that then go in to create this meat, you know, all of that is so energy and resource intensive that actually, you know, considering you could get livestock from the land for free with free resources that are easily accessible and could benefit the land itself, you know, just I think the disparity there was very interesting. You sort of displayed that very nicely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a catch-22 here that people think, oh, I can't have grass-fed beef because there's no grass here. But the reason there's no grass there is because there's no beef. There's no beef.
Yeah.
And the importance of the ecosystem was something that I'd not really thought much about before, that you can't, like, a field of wheat is not a full ecosystem in the way that we quite
and to
think.
Create and to turn a field of wheat into, you know, a profitable resource, you need to actively sort of work against the ecosystem that would potentially exist there, right? Mm. Because you get rid of the insects and the pests and the other diseases that could be affecting the crop, but they're actually part of a normal ecosystem. So if you create a food system whereby the natural ecosystem is encouraged and maybe adapted such that it creates the, you know, food for humans rather than trying to force a certain monocrop or single type of ecosystem, then actually you could end up with a healthier planet and healthier people, obviously, mm-hmm. too, because maybe some more meat for some people would actually be a good thing.
Mm-hmm. I saw the CEO of Compassion in World Farming present at River Cottage with Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall on our travels. And the message there was that we should be eating less meat and better quality meat. And of course, who could disagree with the idea of...
That's absolutely true.
Well, there was actually several ideas you could not disagree with. And one was eating more plants.
Yeah.
Another was eating better quality meat. But it emerged somewhere in his presentation that he was a vegan and that maybe this eating less meat thing was what this was really all about. And the fundamental flaw in his thinking was that all diets are equal to humans. Right. Yeah. We know this is not true. And I think about, we went to the Natural History Museum in London and we saw Guy the Gorilla. And I learned about all the things that we learned about the diet that the gorilla must eat while it's in captivity. They put tremendous effort into learning about how to keep these animals alive in captivity. You know, the modern gorillas in London Zoo now, their diet has, so much work has been gone into like understanding what that animal needs to eat in order to thrive. And then when it comes to humans, oh no, they can just eat it. Like, they can eat lentils, pulses. It's got protein in it, right? It's all the same. We just eat it. And more refined carbs, that's fine. We can just turn these things into cereal and bread and that's all going to be fine. We just need to eat less meat. It's just so, I just can't understand that. Like, have you not looked elsewhere? It's the danger of specializing. You need to zoom out and look at this problem that somebody else has solved and see how they solved it.
That kind of reminds me of going back to the caloric restriction argument. And I was thinking about this recently. I don't know which will come out first, but I went on STEM Talk the Stem Talk podcast, and I was researching some of the so the calorie restriction stuff, because I know Ken wanted to talk about some of that stuff, and talking about the calorie restriction studies in monkeys and whether those are relevant to humans. And if you look at the quality of the diet, like they're actually giving these monkeys like sugar and soybean oil, and if you give them less of it, they live longer. So that sounds a lot like a Western diet. And these monkeys, they're also, you know, inside in a lab facility. And then, you know, I suddenly thought that so monkeys inside under artificial lights eating soybean and sugar, and that just made me think of, well, that's basically humanity right now. Mm-hmm. So actually, you know, then restricting calories might be a beneficial thing, but you've created so many artificial things along the way that it just doesn't really make any sense anymore. And if you actually looked at what it takes for a human to be optimally healthy, right, then you might come up with a completely different answer. Mm-hmm. But nobody's really done that. So nobody spent the time with the human as they did with the gorilla to try and figure out, so caloric restriction works when you've put the monkey in a cage inside and it's not moving and it's under artificial light.
Right.
But what if there's something so much better, which is that the monkey is outside and he can eat whatever, you know, he's supposed to be eating.
But why is this difficult to understand, why it's not the obvious answer? Well, let's just have a look at how the monkey is in the wild. Like, its DNA, like there was pressure from the environment that shaped this animal into what it is today. Is that not the place you should start before you start to, and can you not do that with humans? Isn't that what paleo is all about, really?
Yeah, exactly. And paleo gets a bad rap for, you know, some of it's deserved, but with, you know, that's the principle, right? The ancestral health principle, that actually we evolved to be here. So maybe if we actually looked at what that involved, could actually maybe inform us in terms of what we should do next.
Hunter-gatherers for the win is the tagline. What's the future for the Icelandic Health Symposium? I was thinking that maybe this might be a good place to talk about, you know, Gudmund Dahr is a fantastic guy that's done a tremendous job with the event so far, and he's obviously incredibly passionate, but perhaps one of his passions is not event organization, and with a baby on the way, this is not going to get any better. I wondered if you want to talk about whether there might be someone out there that's passionate about health and organizing events that might be able to help you and your colleagues at the Icelandic Health Symposium in the future?
Yeah.
Somewhat of a leading question.
I guess the answer is obvious. So, I mean, what we've learned over the last couple of years, and I have been involved, but it's largely been helping to arrange the speakers. And I know that organization is not my strong suit, and I also don't have time to do that, especially because I live abroad. Mm-hmm. So that's never going to be my part of the organization. And then the other people in the organization are also people who are health advocates or working in the health system. So Gudmund is an emergency physician, you know, so he's doing night shifts half the time and he's always fighting fires. And then trying to organize a conference becomes very difficult. And I think, you know, done a fantastic job the last couple of years, but I also know that, you know, they've nearly killed him. And whether it continues will be dependent on other people coming in to help. So obviously we would prefer it to be people based in Iceland or with a connection to Iceland. So if you know any Icelanders or you are an Icelander and you're interested in helping to organize, we would love to hear from you, because we are not people with the skills in marketing organization, but there are people who have those skills, and we're very interested in bringing some more people on board to make sure this continues and gets the word out. And, you know, maybe there could have been more people that knew about this conference than did. And, you know, we could have had more people there and more people then helping other people. So that's something, I think, if it continues, and I certainly hope it does continue, because I think the message is important, then I think getting in more people to help organize and get the word out is going to be important too. So if there is anybody listening who's interested in that, that would be great.
Cool. I'll leave an email address in the show notes. It's support@nourishbalancedthrive.com. If you come to the show notes, I'll write that down so that you can find it. Well, I think that's about it. Slightly long one, but really good. Thank you, Tommy, for your time. And thank you for organizing the event and hosting us here in Iceland. It's been fantastic.
Well, you're welcome. It's been great.
Thank you.